I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time. May it please the court, my name is Grace Stewart, and I represent the appellant in this case, Bryant Martin. In my opening brief to this court, I allege that the trial court made 2 errors. I'd like to start with the second one at this time, and that is that the sentence information from the prior conviction should have been redacted and should not have been shared with the jury at the guilt phase.
Well, and in your brief, you cite Burke, which is a very appropriate cite, and clearly establishes that it was error. But the rest of Burke says that you review it for whether it's harmless or not, and given what Burke holds, that unless it impacted the actual sentence in some manner, that we can hold that it's harmless. Given that he got the mandatory minimum sentence, isn't it definitionally harmless?
No, Judge, and obviously Burke is very similar, but it is somewhat different. First of all, I think getting to the mandatory minimum portion of that argument assumes that the jury would find him guilty in the first place. I think that introducing that information of the prior conviction gives the jury a lot of information. You know, not only does it tell them that this person was convicted of something, but, for example, in this case, it tells them that he was given 1.5 years of time for that prior conviction. I think that's prejudicial to the jury and not relevant.
But wasn't that the same thing that happened in Burke?
Well, he only received 90 days of jail time on the sentence conviction that was introduced to the jury at the guilt phase.
But in Burke, we found it was harmless error, even though they didn't give him the minimum sentence.
Yes, well, I think it was found to be harmless error because of the other facts in that case, which are distinguishable from the other facts in this case. For example, in Burke, the only elements of that offense are his driver's license status and whether he was driving. In this case, it's not just does he have a prior conviction, but possession and the other elements of possession. You know, was it knowledge? What sort of possession that he had of that firearm? Did he know that it was there? Did he actually have possession? Obviously, in this case, he didn't have the firearm on his person. It was in the residence. And I think that the facts in this case are somewhat different from the facts of Burke. And I don't think that I don't think that it's harmless error in this case because the facts are distinguishable.
Well, didn't he admit to having the gun?
He said, I would have possessed the gun to protect my family. He didn't say, I have possession of this gun.
But it was in his closet with his clothes.
He didn't admit that it was his closet with his clothes. That evidence came from Ms. Watkins, which obviously I have issue with her testimony as well.
But it was the closet in the bedroom that had men's clothes in it.
It did have men's clothes in it, but it didn't have any identification of his.
But the identity of the two people who resided in that bedroom were her and him.
And that came from her testimony. And so, obviously, I think that Burke is similar but different enough. And so I would urge this court to find that it's not harmless error in this case. I also think it's distinguishable from Burke in that the judge wanted to redact that information, but he believed that he could not. He made reference to new cases it's not clear what he was referring to, but he said that's not necessarily, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's the law, and I have to include that information. I think that the judge might have been thinking that information, the sentencing information, is relevant at the sentencing portion of trial, not the guilt portion of trial. And I'm sure that's what he was referring to. And so I also think that it's an abuse of discretion under Lawler when you look at it from that context.
Let me come back to my question.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to check. Didn't he say that after being advised of his Miranda rights, didn't he admit there were 2 guns inside the residence, one of which was located in the closet, and he possessed them because he was the man of the house and wanted to protect the family?
I believe he said he would possess them if he had to.
Well, if he did, and I'll preface that as a hypothetical, he did admit possession of the guns, wouldn't even the unredacted information be harmless?
Well, I think it's also important to remember that these are not his own statements that he made at trial under oath. These are
statements. But the trier of fact could conclude that he said them.
I understand the court's point, but
if he admitted, and I preface make this a hypothetical, but if he did admit the possession of the guns, wouldn't that make the unredacted sentence harmless?
I still think it doesn't because of the judge's desire to redact it, but he believed that he could not. And I think that's
What would it have added to the case that would have allowed the jury to find him, where the jury would have found him guilty, where they wouldn't otherwise?
You're asking with his admission.
Yeah, I mean, what difference did it make?
What difference does the sentence make?
In terms of the overwhelming evidence of guilt.
I think that any time you have a panel of jurors judge information like that could be prejudicial.
But our harmless error cases allow us to find harmless error in jury cases.
Yes.
And this is a constitutional harmless error on at least the second one. Second assignment of error, correct?
I don't think that it is harmless error.
Well, the analysis would be for non-constitutional harmless error as opposed to constitutional harmless error.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
There are two different standards that we look at harmless error. There's for a constitutional violation, a quote, federal constitutional harmless error analysis, and there's a non-constitutional error, harmless error analysis. For assignment of error two, you would only be entitled to the second, correct? There's no constitutional right at issue.
Correct. And moving on to unless Your Honor's having more questions about that assignment of error, yes. I'd move on to the assignment of error regarding Ms. Watkins pending felony charges. I think that any time that a witness has a potential bias, I think that's always relevant. I think that's something that a jury is entitled to know about.
I'd like to ask you about the content and timing of the proffer.
Yes.
Is there a problem that no attempt to proffer what the testimony would be was made when the witness was there and subject to being called? I know that there are cases when the judge says proffer it later, but that's not what happened here. What happened here is there was an objection. The judge ruled on the objection. There was no additional argument made. The witness was excused and was excused by both parties, so presumably not subject to recall. The Commonwealth called another witness. That witness was called. The Commonwealth then rested, and then and only then was the proffer. And we'll get to the content of the proffer in a minute, was the proffer made. Is that a problem?
No, I don't think it is, for a couple reasons. First of all, that proffer was unobjected to by the Commonwealth. And second, the judge in sustaining the objection, I think was very forceful in saying, I don't want to hear any more about this line of questioning. You can move on. And so I think that counsel simply just made the proffer at a later time when it was more appropriate, considering the fact that the jury is in the presence of the jury and the judge says, no, I'm sustaining this objection. You have to move on, counsel.
When the first issue with the content of the proffer is the first time that the words Sixth Amendment or Constitution are related to this issue that I can find in the record is in the petition and in the brief. They weren't raised at trial, correct?
Well, I'm sorry, which issue?
Regarding the right of cross-examination being curtailed, no constitutional argument was raised at trial.
No, it was just a proffer. I mean, well, that's because the only objection was relevance. And so defense counsel responded to that objection and said it would be relevant, and here's why.
But didn't argue, and I have a constitutional right to do this.
No.
Are you familiar with our decision in Cortez-Hernandez?
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, in Cortez-Hernandez, we found that a failure to argue that it had violated your Sixth Amendment confrontation right removed the constitutional aspect of the issue. If you didn't argue that when you objected to the evidence and made the proffer at trial, that you lose the constitutional harmless error point. Do you have any argument as to why that shouldn't be the case here?
Well, again, I would just rely on the argument that this is relevant. Obviously, in my brief, I argue that it's relevant because any time a witness is biased, it's relevant, and that was the objection that was sustained at trial.
Okay.
Well, let's assume it's relevant. I tend to agree with you that it probably was, and you probably should have been able to ask the question. I still got to go back to where I've been on this thing, and I've looked up the appendix. What did he indicate as to whether or not there was a firearm in the house? He said there were two. Specifically, did he tell you about the location? Yes, he did. He said there was a weapon in the closet. And then he said, I asked him why he was in possession of a firearm if he was convicted of a felony. He stated that Mrs. Watkins had some past relationship problems and he was in fear for the family. I asked him where the weapon was. He said it was in his closet. I asked him why. He said because he was the man of the house, and if he had to protect his family, he would do so because he was the man of the house. That sounds an awful lot to me like an, if not admission, a confession. And if, in fact, he said that, what did this even if you impeach the witness, how are you going to get around that? How is that not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, making the witness's testimony or error harmless?
Well, again, I don't think it's harmless because of the judge's desire to include that information, but addressing
now,
that point
about,
specifically...
I'm talking about your cross-examination, your limitation of cross-examination. Even if you had impeached that witness to the point the judge says, I'm not going to believe a thing coming out of that woman's mouth.
And that would have been the goal.
Yeah, and I'm sure you may have been able to do that. But the judge then points to, but look at his confession.
Well, is it a confession or is it...
Look at his confession.
To me, that sounds like the officer says, why did you possess the firearm? And he doesn't actually say that in his own words.
Right.
I think it's slightly different.
If I ask you, why are you standing at the podium, and you say, because that's where I'm supposed to stand, I can conclude you're standing at the podium.
That's one way to interpret that.
I'm trying to come up with another way.
I think in this case, again, because it's not exactly a testimony from the defendant in this case, it's the police officer's recollection paraphrasing.
I think he was reading from his notes, if I'm correct.
Which he wrote several hours later.
And we're in your rebuttal time, but I do
yes.
have one additional question
yes,
about
Judge.
The proffer. Where in the record is it proffered what she would have answered if asked, if allowed to answer the question?
Judge, that is on Joint Appendix page 168, where defense counsel asserts that the answer to the question would have shown that she had bias or motive to fabricate.
No, that's what he intended to show from the what was intended to be shown from the question.
Yes.
What would she have said? It's not enough to proffer, I wanted to ask these questions. You have to proffer what the expected answer would be and give the Commonwealth an opportunity to say, no, we don't think that would have been the answer.
Well, I think it goes without saying that, you know, it's clear that she believed that Ms. Watkins would have said, yes, I have pending felony charges, and that those pending charges, the evidence would have been relevant to show her bias.
Have you ever been in a criminal trial where somebody was asked if they had convictions and they gave, or charges, and they said no, and then they had to be impeached some other way?
I'm not sure if I have.
Okay.
Been.
We cut deeply into your rebuttal time. I'll try to give you a
little
more.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. And with the Court's permission, I'll take the assignments of error in the same order and start with the second. With respect to the conviction of sentencing order, Judge Russell, there's not much I can say that you haven't already mentioned. I think that Burke is controlling.
You would concede it was error to include it.
Yes, Your Honor. It was error to include it at the guilt phase of the court.
You'd concede that there was error on both assignments, wouldn't you?
I'm sorry.
The cross-examination.
The cross-examination should have been allowed as well, whether it was preserved or not is a different question.
Yes, Your Honor, because the issue with respect to the first assignment error is whether it was preserved properly and ultimately whether it was harmless error. But no, I don't particularly disagree that would have been relevant towards bias, whether it happened. And I, you know, the Commonwealth dropped a footnote that dealt with, you know, I was honestly curious about the charges because I couldn't find them anywhere. And without getting into...
I think they're right. I'm not allowed to read that.
Yeah. And without getting what's into relegated in there, I do think that ultimately, whether or not it was related to bias could have gone forward. But what we have to deal with now is whether that proffer was adequate, first, and second, in any event, whether there was harmless error, which is an analysis the court would always conduct, regardless of the answer to that first question. But with respect to the conviction and sentencing order, I do think, contrary to Martin's argument, that the cases are indistinguishable. Burke was charged with driving as an habitual offender.
Your opponent colleague has suggested that taking your concession of the error of the trial court with regard to the issue, that the degree of punishment that was suggested in that order may well have influenced the fact finder in the disposition of the guilt in this particular case. What would be your response to that?
I respectfully disagree, Judge Alston, and I think this court's holding in Burke is consistent with my position on that point. And with the court's permission in Burke, he was convicted of driving as a, he was charged with driving as a habitual offender. The Commonwealth sought to introduce the prior conviction, which would have supported the habitual offender. Just like in this case, the defense sought to have the sentencing portion redact. Just like in this case, the judge there did not redact the punishment that, that was in the conviction order. And this court stated in that case, they expressly mentioned that the evidence against Burke was, quote, overwhelming, and that he did not object to the portion of that conviction order regarding the conviction itself, just the sentencing. The court said, quote, that they could, we could conclude without usurping the jury's fact-finding function that had the error not occurred, the verdict of guilty would have been the same. And they based that upon, again, the overwhelming evidence against Mr. Burke. In this case, Judge Petty, as you mentioned previously, Mr. Martin confessed to the police officers, exclusive of Ms. Watkins' testimony. Multiple police officers testified that he told them that there were two guns in the house. He told them where they could be found. The police officer went, found the gun inside of a men's clothing, or inside of a closet that had exclusively men's clothing. He told the police officers that he knew he was a convicted felon, and he told them he possessed the gun because he was the man of the house and he wanted to protect his family. And that's the testimony of several police officers. So the evidence in this case is overwhelming. I mean, he confessed. Essentially, Ms. Watkins' testimony would have been icing on the cake, but I don't believe it was necessary in the slightest to support the conviction. So, again, that evidence...
Her testimony was about some other gun besides the one in the closet.
Correct, Your Honor.
But there was just one charge.
Just one charge. She had testified that she was concerned because of her children. She had seen two long guns in the house, and she ultimately found a shotgun inside the box spring, took a picture, emailed the police, and they came and picked it up. But again, as you mentioned, Mr. Martin was only charged with one count of possession, which was supported by the rifle that they
found. By that time, they'd already found the other gun.
Thanksgiving night, yes, sir.
And arrested him.
Yes, and that occurred. Ms. Watkins finding the shotgun happened some weeks after this initial incident, which actually occurred in the early morning of Thanksgiving. But I think what's particularly relevant is, again, with respect to the sentencing order, is that in Burke, this case held that the jury's knowledge of the jail sentence that the defendant received could have affected only the sentence the jury recommended because the evidence was overwhelming. And in Burke, it's actually more egregious because there the jury recommended a sentence of 3 years, which was 2 years below the statutory maximum. In this case, the jury imposed the mandatory minimum sentence. There was no lesser sentence that the jury could have imposed in this case. So ultimately, while I concede that, yes, that the sentencing portion should have been redacted, it's the Commonwealth's position that the exactly as it was in Burke,
the
error was harmless.
So the unique fact and circumstances of this particular case suggests an even more application of the harmless error standard because it could not and did not affect what was ultimately provided to the defendant as a sentence.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. And with respect to the first assignment of error, the Commonwealth put forward two different arguments. The first is that Martin failed to make a proper proffer.
Well, you know, they proffered that the witness had three pending felony charges. That in and of itself is subject to cross-examination. Isn't it true you have pending felony charges?
And I think it's important to look at the actual words of the proffer, and as the counsel noted, that's on page 168 of the appendix. And what it said is, again, Judge Petty, as you just mentioned, that she had three felony charges pending for two counts of grand larceny and one count of credit card fraud, and that, quote, the evidence would have been relevant to show her bias in order to fabricate that she had reason.
There was a proffer made that she had pending felony charges. That's all the proffer that you have to make. The impact of those felony charges is the argument of counsel. And ladies and gentlemen, that's why she's lying, because she's looking for leniency from the Commonwealth. It's the inference to be drawn from those.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully suggest that I think the proffer intended more than that. And I think what the proffer was intending to, especially by that additional language, the evidence would have been relevant to show her bias in order to fabricate. There was something more. The fact that she said the court has seen cases all the time where, you know, a witness testifies and says, yes, I have, you know, charges pending against me. No, I don't expect leniency. No, well, you know,
I've done a lot of cross-examination in my life, and the one thing that I always remember is you never ask the last question. You argue the last question. It's not a matter of whether she would admit that she was testifying in hopes of seeking benefit from the Commonwealth. That's the inference that the Commonwealth is going, or, sorry, that the defense attorney is going to argue to the jury. So all he has to proffer, she has to proffer, is the fact that there was evidence that there were pending felony charges. Isn't that the way we have to look at this?
Well, Your Honor, I certainly understand the court's point, and it is well taken, but I do believe it is distinguishable, and I think if we look at the Supreme Court of Virginia's decision in Hewitt, which is a 1984 case, there, and I think the contrast is stark, the evidence showed that the potential bias was far greater. What defense counsel established there was that the witness had an extensive criminal record. He was an undercover informant for the police, had voluntarily cooperated with the police to obtain his release from jail. He had made false statements to the police. He had escaped from custody. And most importantly, he had a written agreement with a U.S. attorney granting him immunity for anything he disclosed in the course of a federal grand jury. Defense counsel there sought to ask the witness whether his testimony concerning that written agreement was biased as a result of the agreement that he might have obtained from the federal authorities in return for implicating the defendant.
Let me just follow up on that last point. Suppose instead of just making a proffer, the jury had gone out, the witness took the witness stand, and the defense attorney says, isn't it true that you have been convicted of three charges, that you have three pending felony charges? And the witness says, yes, that's true. And the defendant then says, I wouldn't suggest it, but then asks, isn't it true that you're testifying in hopes of receiving a benefit from the Commonwealth? And the witness says, no, that's not true. Are you telling me that the judge would then be, it would be proper for the judge to say, I'm not going to allow that line of questioning?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
So why do you have to proffer the answer to that last question if it wouldn't have made any difference as to whether or not the cross-examination was proper?
Because in this case, I again, I'm not trying to split hairs with the court, there was more to the proffer than just those three pending felony charges, at least as...
question is, from this record,
yes, sir,
was an answer to the question of do you have pending felony charges ever proffered?
No, it wasn't. And that's a point that I think this court reflected in times.
Seems to me the answer could have been yes.
Or it could have been no.
And then they would have to, we would, to know what impact that would have, we would have to have additional information.
Correct.
In fact, I believe Mr. Martin's brief actually concedes that at some point, and then of course whatever the answer would have been, there would have had to have been follow-up questions.
Correct.
And none of those were proffered in any way, shape, or form.
No, and while I don't want to appear to be nitpicking, I think it is important, and Judge Russell, your comment reflects this, is this was somewhat, you know, given in the third person. There was no Miss Watkins would have said that she had previously, or that she had these charges pending.
Why are you arguing that point when you have such a solid argument on harmless error?
Well, I
why
do,
do you
Your
want
Honor.
Us to go down a road and require an overly technical statement of proffer when you have such a winner in harmless error?
Well, and again, Your Honor, I'm not trying to be trite with the court, and it was my honest interpretation of the Times case where, for example, there... and this was a decision out of this court from 2006. For example, there was a proffer concerning contraband, and the court found it to be inadequate. And what the defense attorney had actually asked was, or in the course of the proffer, had said that contraband was found rather among the personal effects and also at the scene of the incident. This court said that counsel did not say the witness would have testified to that fact. Now, I understand that's a little bit nitpicky, but I do think it's an important point. Saying the evidence would have shown X, Y, or Z is not the same thing as saying the witness would have testified X, Y, and Z, which I think is what Judge Russell was getting to when there was no expected answer. But I agree, and I don't want to spend much more time on it, because in the end, I ultimately think that the harmless analysis or harmless error analysis prevails.
One last question about the proffer.
Does yes,
the
sir.
Commonwealth have any take any issue with it being done after the close of the Commonwealth's case and after the witness had been excused by both parties?
In good faith, Your Honor, I don't think I can now. I did not raise it at the brief, and I think that I certainly don't think this is one of the types of cases where the court prevents a defense attorney from making a proffer at that time, but it was made on the record prior to the conclusion of the evidence, and the Commonwealth did not object to what defense counsel provided.
I'm going out on a limb here, but I'm just guessing with a jury in the box that the defense attorney had said, Your Honor, would you send that jury out for a while so we could take this witness's proffer for the record? There probably would have been move along, next question.
And that would be speculation, and if that was the case, then defense counsel might have had the better argument with respect to this court's decision of the law, saying the best way to get a proffer on the record is to do exactly what you just said and put the witness on the stand outside the presence
but
of
counsel,
the jury. But there was no attempt to do that.
And while I agree with Judge Petty's observation, there was nothing to prevent counsel from not agreeing to release the witness.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And so, very briefly, I'll just simply say that, outside of that analysis, harmless error should prevail. The evidence was overwhelming for the reasons stated previously, and I won't bore the court with reiterating.
I call your argument the Tom Brady approach. You just want to run up the score because you can.
Your Honor, as a anti-Patriots fan, I won't take exception to that, but I do appreciate it. So, unless the court.
The air out of your
Thank you.
Stop with the football analogies.
You want to address the proffer for a moment? That
yes, I would
to
like
be
to
an
address.
Argument here.
I think that if there had been an objection to the proffer by the Commonwealth, and certainly the fact that the witness had already been excused, that would have created a problem. But because there was no objection to the proffer, neither that it was made without the witness or that the content of the proffer, I don't think we have any issues with the proffer because of what happened at trial. And further, I would argue that none of this is harmless error, because I think if both the sentence had been redacted from the prior and Ms. Watkins had been further impeached by that line of questioning, this would be a different case with less reliable evidence from the Commonwealth and less prejudicial evidence in terms of at the guilt phase.
Thank you for your
Thank you.